WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Those of us who listen to and enjoy jazz are frequently at a loss when we try to find the words to describe the music and the sensations that it creates within us. We may look to the jazz critic for the ability to communicate the force of music through language and to try to place that music within the larger history that it's a part of. My guest Gary Giddens, one of the best jazz critics, writes for The Village Voice. A collection of his essays from the 70s has just been published by Oxford under the title Writing on a Blue Note, Jazz and American Pop. Francis Davis, who hosts Fresh Air's jazz feature Interval, reviewed the book for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and I'd like to quote him. He wrote of the writers presently reporting jazz on a regular basis, Gary Giddens is the one I would want as my guide were I just beginning to listen. He's the one I read with most pleasure as an experienced listener with strong convictions of my own. Giddens' pieces richly deserve the status and the permanence that publication between two hard covers confers on them. Giddens' book includes essays on performers and composers of jazz and pop. Among his subjects are Ethel Waters, Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, Sonny Rollins, Charlie Parker, Duke Ellington, Ornette Coleman, Charles Mingus, and Cecil Taylor. And by the way, Gary Giddens will be making regular trips to Philadelphia beginning in the fall when he... beginning in January when he starts to teach a course on the history of jazz at the University of Pennsylvania. Gary Giddens, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Nice to see you again.
I'm interested that your book starts with a collection of essays on popular singers, and it seems to me that a lot of jazz listeners scorn popular music, people like Sinatra, but particularly someone like Crosby. And I wonder if you've always been interested in the people who just cross that line between pop and jazz, or if you've recently developed an interest in them.
Well, the nature of my interest changed. Often I find that when I write an article about someone, an enormous amount of research may go into the writing, but it's only after the piece appears that I will become so obsessed with the artist that I'll continue to discover things about him or her, and in a few years have a very different opinion often. Bing Crosby started out as an assignment to cover him, and I didn't really know very much about him, and it was in the course of doing that piece of going to see him, speaking with him very briefly, that I started to listen to the recordings in a way that I'd never really listened to them before and came to conclusions about him. Sinatra, interestingly enough to me, I originally wrote about Sinatra in 75, I think it was, for The Voice. And at that time, I didn't like him as a person. I still don't. But I'm afraid I let that get into the way of the kind of review I was doing. And I had been listening to him all my life, but I hadn't really been hearing him. He was always there in the background. He made so many miserable records at that period that I let those confuse me because I hadn't heard too many of the really good ones. And that, combined with the fact that he gave a perfectly atrocious performance at the Eros Theater and the fact that I didn't like him to begin with, all contributed to my writing a rather negative review. But it was only after it appeared that I became – but in the course of that, I became so interested that I – started to listen to more and more Sinatra and came to be a great admirer as I started to listen to the really good things he'd done and realized how unique he is. When he came back to New York in 1978, gave a brilliant performance at the Radio City Music Hall, I took a completely different attack. Sometimes with a performer like Sinatra, you simply have to accept the good with the bad and be able to distinguish between the two.
Do you wonder if he's able to distinguish between the two?
I don't know, frankly. I think at one point I know that he could. Right now, I don't know. It really confuses me, and it fascinates me, too. I know that he knows when he's singing well, because when he came back to New York the last time, I reviewed him when he was at Carnegie Hall last year, and he had just put out the trilogy record. Strangely enough, Sinatra and I, although we have not met, have a mutual friend. And the friend told me that he was really in training for this performances and for the record, which means that he'd stopped drinking or maybe just having one a night or something, and he wasn't smoking. So, and that makes, you know, he's a man who has continuously abused his equipment, and it tells. You can tell his voice has gone in and out of whack just about every decade since he's started making it as a star performer. And you can tell when he's really working. And I think he knows it. He knows when he's up there as a singer and he's absolutely sure of what he's doing. Whereas at the Eurus, he was so contemptuous of the audience, and I think that reflected his own uncertainty about his voice, which was in terrible disrepair. As far as material is concerned, I try to deal with that subject in the book about how does a popular performer go about being au courant and at the same time finding the songs that are most suitable for him. It's difficult to tell. The man has a monstrous ego, and I don't think that the Sinatra of 20 years or 30 years ago would have been willing to sing, for example, that Gordon Jenkins oratorio that is a celebration of Sinatra's greatness or saintliness. But you can't be sure. When he was at Columbia in the early 50s, which was the nadir of his career, and Mitch Miller took over the operations of that company, and he had to sing real garbage, he was continuously fighting about it. And you knew damn well that the Sinatra of that period knew what a good song was and what junk he was being asked to perform. I don't think he would agree with me when I say that a lot of the things he's doing now are junk. I don't think he feels that way. But
well, as you point out, a lot of singers and musicians as well feel that it's their duty to remain current, and that if you're not current, if you don't sing the pop tunes of the day, that you're going to be a throwback, just, you know, memories from the past. What do you think of the material that he's singing that's current pop songs?
Well, some of it's good. And it's not so much that the material is good, but a really good singer can take lousy material and make it good. Now, Sinatra's no Billie Holiday. You could give Billie Holiday songs that are absolutely beyond the pale. I mean, you look at them in sheet music, and they simply have no reason for being. For a song like It's a Sin to Tell a Lie or Sailboat in the Moonlight, which are two of the greatest records she ever made. Sinatra cannot do that. Sinatra needs good material, which he makes better. But if you give him songs like Badly Roy Jones, for the most part, and That's Life and a lot of junk, it's going to come out as junk, however much you like his voice. However, he has been able to find material which did not impress me in anyone else's performance, which I think he's turned into classic stuff. That Billy Joel song, which I find deplorable in almost every other performance, I think in every other performance I've ever heard. But I think what he does with it is incredible. But the best of them is New York, New York, which he's turned into his personal anthem, and that's a song that unimpressed me when I first heard it in its original context.
Gary, if you were a singer, do you know what songs you'd be performing?
Yes. This is a major a pet peeve with me. It seems to me that one of the problems over material is that the singers themselves, especially the star performers, no longer have either the energy or the inclination to do the research work that's required to find out what's already been done. And their producers, for the most part, steer them in the opposite direction. No producer is going to say to Sarah Vaughan, let's do a song of Irving Berlin songs that nobody's ever heard, or Billy Strayhorn songs, let's commission lyrics. They never will do that. They will always say, let's do a record of the Beatles, or let's do a record of Neil Diamond, or whatever, who I think is just more deplorable than I would be willing to use the appropriate language on radio. So they skip a lot of the really interesting things from the so-called Tin Pan Alley period. I think that the Ella Fitzgerald songbooks is an exemplary way of going about it. And it seems to me that Ella Fitzgerald, although she did a good deal more than crack the surface, left a lot of stuff that's unmined. Billy Strayhorn, to begin with. There's a lot of good Billy Strayhorn songs, and nobody ever sings them. The only Strayhorn song that everybody knows is Lush Life. Occasionally someone will do Daydream. I haven't heard anybody do A Flower is a Lovesome Thing, for example, since Ella Fitzgerald recorded it in the 60s. A lot of his songs don't have lyrics and should. I think Monk has written a couple of ballads. Ruby, My Dear, it's a gorgeous song. I once heard somebody sing that with a set of makeshift lyrics, and that deserves a good lyric. Berlin has written songs. I didn't even know this when I wrote the Berlin piece. Again, this is a piece that I did so much research, and it's only afterwards that either people wrote letters to me or other people who recognizing my interest just turned me on to facets of his career that I had not found out about on my own. And one is that before he became a popular songsmith in, the late teens, he wrote a whole passel of songs that have never been performed in that raggy kind of idiom that he was trying to appropriate. And some of them are really fascinating harmonically. There's one song that was used as the Marx Brothers theme in one of their first films. I can't remember if it was Animal Crackers or Coconuts. It's a silly song. It's a horrible lyric and title called The Monkey Doodle Doo. Unfortunate. The changes are practically out of Gershwin. And this is 10 years before Gershwin. And there's a lot of Brooks Kerr, I don't know if you know him, a pianist and singer, called me up one afternoon. And he will call me up sitting at his piano when he wants to share something with me. And he is a Berlin fanatic. Berlin and Ellington are his two, and Waller. And he just started singing and playing one Berlin tune after another and telling me the dates. And we just couldn't believe how advanced some of his ideas were. There's a whole area there that needs to be explored, not by critics only, but by singers, the people who can make the music come real. Richard Whiting is a songwriter who hasn't been done justice to in ages. Walter Donaldson, Fred Fisher, not to mention Kern. I mean, you know, maybe the greatest of them all, and Gershwin. The material is great.
Are there contemporary composers whose work you'd want to mine if you were singing?
Well, I suppose every once in a while I do hear a good song, but it's always an isolated instance. I can't think of any songwriter. I mean, what's his name? Sondheim is an interesting composer, but not so much of popular songs. He's only had a couple of... I can't think of anybody... I suppose... I can't think of any songwriter who consistently scores. In the 60s, I thought, my God, Johnny Mandel is going to be a really important songwriter, but it never really happened. He only had two or three interesting songs, and the others don't sound very good. Bacharach, who I used to put down mercilessly in the 60s, and I had bets with people that in 10 years they wouldn't be listening to him, and everybody said, no, he's Richard Rodgers, he's a Cole Porter. And I think Bacharach, time has proven it, how meretricious and ridiculous most of those songs are. I Say a Little Prayer for You. I mean, I thought that was embarrassing then, and I think most people are beginning to realize that it's an embarrassment now.
Isn't he responsible for Raindrops Keep a Falling
on My
Head?
Oh, my God, he sure is. And that's the song that Richard Rodgers says he wished he had written. No, Richard Bacharach is emblematic of the kind of songwriter who starts off as a serious composer, a serious songwriter, and then he says, he looks around him and he says, this is how I'm going to make hits. This is the sentiment. This is what's being turned out, and they do it. The reason why you don't hear great melodies, I think, on the radio now is because of this infatuation or this pretentious ambition to be profound in the lyrics. If the lyrics come first, which they ought never to do, then the music takes a back seat because you're worried about articulating. See, this never happened to the classic songwriters. They came up with a melody.
Well, as you point out, Ethel Waters articulates very well, but felt under no obligation to sing songs that defined the nature of relationships and man's relation to God and the earth, like a lot of.
Yeah, of course, a good singer will fool you every time and make you think you're hearing profound lyrics, even if they're not. When Billie Holiday sings, I mentioned It's a Sin to Tell a Lie, when she says, I love you, yes, I do, I love you, you think it's the most glorious love song you've ever heard in your life. But then you listen to Fats Waller do the same song and he brings you back to earth. It makes you realize it's just Tin Pan Alley trash.
Well, let's get back to some Sinatra. We were just talking about Sinatra. And this is from his days on Capitol Records with arrangements by Nelson Riddle, which I think you say is the best of his recording periods.
Of his arrangers. Oh, Nelson Riddle, I meant, yes. This is the best period from the 50s, and Nelson Riddle is quite an interesting arranger because even though he's definitely pop-prone, he knows jazz, he knows good harmonies when he hears it, and he's a very clever man.
There's space for the singer in there, too, when he arranges in this album.
Yes, and he uses usually sticks a soloist in there. I think Harry Edison is probably on this one. He's on most of them from that period. And he always had Red Mitchell on bass, and you listen, you can always hear strong bass lines in these records. And... unfortunately, Sinatra and Nelson Riddle had several fallings out, and since the last one, he hasn't worked with them. It's been mostly Don Costa. Blah. But someone told me, I think it was Al Cohn, said that he had heard that Riddle and Sinatra are maybe back. So we'll see.
Okay, you had said that Richard Rodgers had said that he wished he wrote Raindrops on My Head. Well, this is a song he really did write, and it's called Dancing on the Ceiling. The lyrics are by Lorenz Hart, and it's an interesting lyric. It's a lot of fun. Let's hear Frank Sinatra sing it.
The world is lyrical because a miracle has brought my lover to me. Though she's some other place, her face I see. At night I creep in bed and never sleep in bed, but look above in the air, and to my greatest joy, My love is there. She dances overhead on the ceiling near my bed. In my sight, all through the night, I try to hide in vain underneath my counterpane. But there's my love up there above. I whisper, go away, my lover. It's not fair. But I'm so grateful to discover that she's still there. I love my ceiling more since it is a dancing floor just for my.
That was Frank Sinatra. My guest is Gary Giddens, and he's just had a new book published. It's a collection of his essays published in the Village Voice initially from the 1970s. The book is called Writing on a Blue Note, Jazz and American Pop, and it's just been published by the Oxford Press. I've noticed that there's stations in different cities, including Philadelphia, that have cropped up that are specializing in pop music from the 50s and early 60s. Mm-hmm. Emphasizing everybody who was big on the charts then. So that means that you hear mostly Perry Como, a lot of Patti Page, a lot of Sinatra, but not much discrimination between the good Sinatra and the tacky Sinatra. A lot of Bennett, also not much discrimination between the kinds of albums that he did.
You know what I think is the most horrible thing about all this? The people who play this and listen to it and put out the propaganda call this the return to good music.
And good taste.
God, that drives me up the wall. And they, you know, Bob Merrill, I think that's his name. Was it Bob Merrill? I think so. Does that name ring a bell to you? A songwriter?
No.
Yeah, there's no reason why it should, except that he wrote most of the biggest records of the 1950s. He was Mitch Miller's, practically his house songwriter. He wrote How Much Is That Doggy in the Window?
Oh.
And all the Guy Mitchell
see,
hits.
I just heard that on the radio.
And he wrote hundreds of songs. He later legitimized himself by writing the lyric to Julie Stein's score for Funny Girl. But in the 50s, he turned out to, I think he even wrote your theme, the city's theme song. There's a pawn shop on the corner in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Mm.
Pittsburgh. Anyway, which was a Guy Mitchell hit. Anyway, they play all that stuff that it was fashionable to dismiss it as garbage only a few years ago, and now they're saying it was really good because this is their response against rock and roll. It seems to me this whole conservative wave we're living through has encouraged a lot of these wimps to come out of the closet, and I'm sure they'll go back in a few years, but right now they come out with this idea that everything that was popular when they were young, when they were in college, swallowing goldfish or whatever they did in those days, is really first rate. That's good music. And so it's really, even though one may prefer Sinatra to Neil Diamond, it's just as dangerous. It's just as, you know, pointless and unfair to what it's nostalgia. They're not open to interesting music. And they just found that there's a commercial audience for it now. Good music is good music. And why? The point that I'd like to make in reference to that and radio is this. Classical music stations play, perhaps they play too much of it, but they have to play a lot of romantic music because that's what the audience wants. And they play it sometimes at the expense of contemporary music, which is a drag. But nonetheless, that's probably better to me than if they played nothing but Boulez and Stockhausen and said that Mozart's old hat. It's almost inconceivable, even though John Cage said the goal of his music was to make it impossible to take Beethoven seriously anymore. Nobody else goes along with that except as a kind of a joke. But in pop music, we don't have that kind of tradition. We don't say, well, you know, this is great stuff and we should continue to listen to it. When we were talking about songwriters before, if a great tenor comes along, he will eventually sing Schubert. Well, if a great pop singer comes along, why should he not sing Porter? We had a period in this country for about 30 years where we produced an incredible number of great melodists. Now, that was just a period. You know, we have periods in literature and theater and whatever, and just because you have a period like that doesn't mean that great songwriters come along every 5 years. They don't. But since we did have one period which produced a Berlin and a Gershwin and a Kern and a Harold Arlen and Cole Porter and Richard Rodgers, it's not about nostalgia when we talk about that material. We're talking about a very high quality of songwriting. And for the most part, the good melodists had good lyrics. You know, Ira Gershwin and Larry Hart and Cole Porter and Berlin may not be profound, but they're not insulting. They're good, clever lyrics that work with the melodies.
I think the music that you like nostalgically gets processed in a different part of your brain and body than other music does. There's certain songs that everybody has or certain records that they grew up with, mm-hmm. even if they hated it when they were growing up with it because someone else had it on the radio. Mm-hmm. It still just sets off all these memories and you go back to it because of that. Is there music? I understand exactly what you're saying about nostalgia mm-hmm. and how that isn't a substitute for good music that stands on its own. But is there music that you get nostalgic about, whether
sure,
that's pop or jazz?
Sure. Oh, there's so much. Because I listened like a fiend when I was a kid. And I find that I'm... And it's the same thing with literature also. I find myself being perhaps... Oh, I'm almost ashamed to confess it, but terribly faithful to things that I enjoyed when I was growing up, even though some part of me tells me that it's really not that good. Now, Coltrane, for example, who I feel very sentimental about Coltrane because one of the most exciting things to me about the 60s was that experience of following him through every record. Where is he going to go next? When the new Coltrane record came out, the world stopped. And today, I think people who were first discovering Coltrane and going back to the records willy-nilly don't have that experience unless you put them all in chronological order and kind of listen to them as we did. I think the Beatles did something similar in the pop audience, and so did Bob Dylan, the idea of making every record a thematic statement and deliberately trying to forge in a different direction. Some of the late Coltrane records, I don't listen to anymore, and if I do, I find them a little tiresome, but nonetheless, they are... I am nostalgic for them because when I was young, I did listen to Ascension 1,000 times until I knew every solo on the record, but I don't know that I can really justify that record on the same level as his really great performances, although I think it's terribly interesting. I am nostalgic about the rock and roll of the late 50s. Most of it still stands up for me. My basic feeling about that period is that they produced an incredible number of really good singers. Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Jackie Wilson, the Coasters, the Drifters, Clyde McFadder, so many really fine voices, Fats Domino. And I do like those records. D. Clark, Jackie. When I listen to Jackie Wilson, there's a certain kind of nostalgic thing that I can't completely... it seems to me that the records have some obvious failings, too. Usually they come from the producer and from an attempt to fit a certain market.
Is there ceremonial music, music for other parties or official family functions, weddings or whatever? And was that music that you enjoyed, or were you exposed to a lot of schlock when...
You mean literally music that one heard at,
yeah.
at ceremonies?
Yeah.
Well, I have a strong feeling for certain Jewish liturgical music that I grew up listening to. I'm very moved by that. I've always felt that there was a very strong relationship between cantorial music and the blues. Musicologically, it's easy to point out certain relationships. And I have a very fond feeling for that. But most of the music that you hear at weddings or bar mitzvahs is just, you know, it's just garbage. It's whatever's on the top 40 played with a simple foxtrot beat. Horrible stuff.
Yeah. Well, Gary, we've been talking a lot about pop music and jazz in this country. In Europe, a lot of jazz has become much more popular on the radio and amongst people than it seems to be in many places in America. We're going to hear Wilhelm Broecker singing an American pop standard, "Let's Fall in Love," and then maybe we could talk
a little bit
afterwards about jazz's function in Europe.
Okay.
Do you want to say a little bit about Broecker before we hear this?
Yes.
And there's an essay about him included in your new book.
Yes. I have not heard this record, so I'm looking forward to it. Broecker is a Dutch saxophonist and bandleader who has a collective, which he calls the Collective. I don't know how you pronounce that, but something like that.
I think
that.
It's Collectif.
Collectif. Very good. Thank you. And I think there's about a dozen musicians in it usually. And what they do is they process all the musics of the world, especially from America, tangos, pop songs, rock, jazz, Kurt Weill, classical stuff, Mahler, and they kind of put it into a blender and come out with strange variations on it. And there's a certain political tinge to it all. In fact, thematically, some of his pieces are quite deliberately iconoclastic, and some of them are deliberately plagiaristic. In fact, one of the pieces is called, I can't remember, it's La Plage something or other, but the point being that everything is stolen, but in fragments. Why don't we listen to this?
Okay, so this is Wilhelm Broecker's recording of Let's Fall in Love.
Time for it while we are young. Don't be afraid of it. Let's close our eyes and make our own paradise. Little we know of it, still we can try to make a go. Be meant for each other to be or not to be, let our hearts discover. Let's fall in love. Why shouldn't we fall in love? Now is the time for it while we are young. Let's fall in love.
Let's fall in love. Why shouldn't we fall in love?
Now is the time for it while we are young. Don't be afraid of it.
Let's close our eyes and make our own paradise.
Was Wilhelm Broecker's Collectif and a recording of Let's Fall in Love. I really liked it. Did you like it?
I liked it. I was disappointed that they did it so straight. I was waiting for his saxophone to explode and for them to go a little out on it. But, the piece I was trying to think of before, incidentally, was La Plagiata.
The one with all the plagiarisms in it.
Yeah, and it's an overall name for about a dozen or so different pieces that he's recorded over the years, each of which steals something from somebody else.
You refer to him in your essay as someone who sees his music as serving an important political function within Europe and his own country. And hearing a song like this, you can wonder, like, what is that political function? So how do some of the European jazz musicians see themselves politically, the ones who define their music politically?
Well, now it changes from country to country. And the most moving instance I can think of would have to be the musicians that come out of the communist countries. And Skovorecki, in his essay on that, gets to the point very well about the protest and the freedom and the individuality that is at the core of the music and how much it meant to them. I saw two guys from East Germany play in the Pori Jazz Festival in Finland about 2 years ago. And they were supposed to be a trio, but one of the three guys could not get a visa out of East Berlin. The other two did. And I was – the music was good. Wasn't great. It was okay. It was kind of a somewhat derived free jazz, except it was played with such grand feeling. And when one of the guys afterwards thanked the audience, he just seemed to be on the about to cry. I was really afraid that the tears were going to start running because they – for them it was a chance to – that music communicated all kinds of – whatever you're feeling. It's immediate expressiveness. And it seems to really be a channel for people who live in countries where jazz has been banned. I met a lot of Russian emigres when I was over there. The pianist named Vladimir Shafranov, who left Russia. Most of these guys, incidentally, first came to jazz through the Conover broadcasts on Radio Free. What's it called?
The Voice of America.
The Voice of America. And for a while, according to Shafranov, it was illegal to listen to the jazz broadcast on Voice of America in Russia. It was illegal to play jazz. And he told me about evenings where they would meet secretively to rehearse and would be really afraid. Then it got to be a little cooler, and you could play and rehearse privately without being afraid of being turned in if you were discreet. But if they wanted to get you, they could use that as an excuse. And yet the potency of this music, the best example of it is that when Benny Goodman took his band over in the late 50s, he expected to be greeted by people who had no idea of what he was doing. And every concert he played, there would be people who would run over to the musicians afterwards. Buddy told me these incredible stories, and they knew their discographies better than any American audience. They were they had secret little groups that they would trade records with and discographical information and all kinds of smuggled material. And, the only place left, I think, in the world where jazz has consistently been banned is China. And it'll be very interesting to see when they open it up if there is a clandestine jazz audience there, because there's proven to be one just about every place else.
So in a way, it's a lot of governments that define the music as being political in their censorship of it.
In their censorship of it, yeah. The jazz is terrifying to the Nazis, the Nazis had a museum, they had one room of a museum in Berlin where they had court vials, Mack the Knife rigged up on a little phonograph in such a way that the needle would be caught on one line and it would just play it over and over and over again, which is a pretty horrifying thought no matter what the music is. And that was to show the decadence of I guess it was Jewish music. But jazz represents that decadence too, because it does not fit into any kind of regimented way of thinking.
A lot of Americans have felt that European jazz is an imitation of the real thing, which is American. Do you think that
for a long
feeling
while
still
it
persists?
Was. Well, Americans don't know, because we don't hardly hear American jazz records over here, let alone European jazz records. I think that more and more it's becoming the case that there are jazz musicians in Europe who are learning how to express their own feelings through the music. But it's interesting that you still can't hardly find a good drummer in Europe or Japan. The Americans always complain about the rhythm section problem there, and yet you find a number of absolutely astonishing bass players because they have that great string tradition. So they're calling on that virtuosic tradition of strings, and they're applying it to jazz, and you're getting so many very fine musicians like Ørsted Petersen and great pianists. Marcel Solal is perhaps the greatest, but there are four or five really extraordinary jazz piano players over in Europe. On the other hand, and now you're first beginning to find saxophone players and people like Breuker and a lot of the musicians in his group. Except for maybe Daniel Humer, though I can't think of a good good European drummer. And of course there was Django Reinhardt, and there was Bengt Hallberg, and there have been good European musicians over the years.
Well, in America, amongst contemporary jazz musicians, particularly in the avant-garde, musicians always or almost always played their own stuff, their own compositions with long improvisations. There seems to be a movement now amongst many avant-garde musicians of going back to the traditions of jazz and to even American popular music.
Because, but let's not forget that American popular music is part of the tradition of jazz.
Right. But it's this movement going back to material that was ignored for a while, or not left untouched by those musicians. Why do you think that's happening? And what do you think of the trend and where it's going?
Well, I think it was inevitable. I never thought for a minute that we weren't going to get back there, even in the heat of the late 60s.
Even when you were listening to Ascension?
No, there's no question about it. I had to go back. Because Ascension is a dead end. You can't, where do you go after that? You can't make 10 Ascensions. And the material is, you know, either the musicians were going to learn how to write melodic compositions, but you know, how much can you learn to do? You can't teach somebody to be Charlie Parker. You can teach someone to play his solos, but you can't teach someone to think like that. And you can't teach someone to be George Gershwin. That's why it's so silly. A lot of these propagandists for the good music, you know, the good taste, the people who like Perry Como, they say, why aren't those songwriters writing like Gershwin and Porter, as though they could just be sat at a desk and turn out melodies like that. So it was inevitable that people were going to start going back and looking and seeing what the tradition was. It seems to me that what we had in jazz in the 60s is analogous to what we've had in all the arts in this century, which is that the art became very self-conscious and went to extreme ends where it was something that was a lot of fun to create but not as much fun to listen to. And I've heard a lot of avant-garde musicians tell me that. I've walked out of a festival recently with someone when a bunch of guys were playing avant-garde, and he said, let's go get a drink. And I said, don't you want to hear this? And he said, that's the kind of music that's a lot of fun to be playing, but nobody wants to listen to it except the guys in the band. And it was inevitable that people were going to start going back and seeing. You know, when you go to that extreme, what are you going to do? When you paint a canvas, it's all black or all white, the next step is to go back and put something on that all white canvas. You've reached. And so what did we get after the white canvas? We got Campbell's soup cans. And now we're getting a whole realm of what painters can do. There's not the kind of prejudice that existed 20 years ago in art, where anybody who did any kind of thing that was realistic was looked down at. Anything that you can do that's personal and original and expressive is okay. And the same thing is true now in jazz. It's okay to go back to Jelly Roll Morton. It's okay to look at Duke Ellington, Berlin, whatever you want to look at in pop or in jazz. And if you can make it work for you, it's legitimate.
But that look has changed by everything that's happened in between.
Absolutely. We'll never go back and do it the same way again. And this won't, you know, for a long time, if somebody played bebop, you played it in the bebop idiom. But now you're getting young musicians who are going back and playing it, and they're just playing it with what they know in a reinterpretive way. They don't look at it as something that's holy that has to be played note for note, because it's there in a holy form already. You want to hear Charlie Parker, the record exists. There's one point that I'd like to make about this, that it's so obvious, but you wouldn't know it from the way music is often written about in this country, and that is that technology is not going to leave us. The record player is here to stay, or it'll be replaced by something similar. Records are not going to disappear any more than paper is. But there's this prejudice that if something's written down, it is eternal. You know, if you have it on a manuscript, it's for all time. It will always be there, always to be interpreted. But if something's on tape and records, well, it's just of the moment, and it'll fade. It's not going to fade. Charlie Parker recordings and tapes are just as eternal as Beethoven manuscripts. And because the musicians know that, and we're getting to know that increasingly well, we don't have to keep reiterating that, and we can go forward. The problem with the technocracy in jazz, if it is a problem, and I think it is in a way, is that it's holding back the idea of jazz repertoire. See, if we had Beethoven recordings, it would be very difficult for people to go around conducting all the various interpretations of his symphonies or of his piano sonatas, because it would be easy for critics to say, hey, man, this is the way Beethoven did it. You can't do it like that, Glenn Gould, or you can't do it like that, Ashkenazi. Here's the way it's supposed to be done. Well, with jazz, because we have it only on records, there's a very closed-minded way. We don't know how to really deal with this repertoire. We don't want to do exact reproductions, because what's the point of that if you have the originals? And then people get very upset if you do something that's too interpretive. And I think that it's important that we get to a point where we can reinterpret the material, and that's what some of the younger musicians like Arthur Blythe, and I can see that we're getting ready to cue him, are leading us to.
Well, you're right. We're getting ready to play a recording by Arthur Blythe from a new album. Do you consider him to be one of the more interesting musicians who is devoting part of their music to?
I think Blythe is just fascinating. For one thing, I can't think of another musician in the history of jazz who has made a reputation for himself at such an advanced age. He didn't start recording until his late 30s. After spending 10, 12 years in California, he was completely ignored by everybody out there. And what he has, among other things, whether you like his music or not, is he not only has an individualistic sound as an alto saxophonist, but he has a group concept that's so rare. You know, like Dave Brubeck, you may or may not like his music, but the Brubeck Quartet has a completely unmistakable sound. And Blythe does not only in one band, but in at least two. And one of the things that gives it that unmistakable quality is the fact that he uses tuba a lot and the way he arranges his material and the fact that he plays with an extremely honeyed vibrato. And he does write material in a originals that are fairly traditional and that they incorporate recognizable forms. He plays classic tunes, and he does something else that's a throwback, especially after the 60s. He plays very pithy solos. They're always short, never more than a couple of choruses. And because he does that, he's getting to be very economic. He can say a lot in 8 bars.
Well, we're going to hear from a new album, his recording of Just a Closer Walk with Thee, which is
delightful.
An old spiritual favorite, I guess. do you want to say anything about this recording before we hear it?
Oh, I just think it's wonderful. When you listen to it, the success of the performance is so obvious that all you can think is, why the hell didn't somebody else think of it? But that's often the almost the definition of really good music. It's a trio performance with Bob Stewart on tuba. Very interesting tuba. Listen to in the first chorus when they play the theme, he plays the first and the third beats, so it's like a march. 1, 2, 3, 4. But then as they start to improvise and play this, he switches it around. He begins to play a kind of contrapuntal walk, but accenting the off beats. On organ, you have Amina Claudine Myers, who's a terribly gifted musician who really hasn't gotten a chance yet on records, and an Arthur, and they just sound like there's such an ebullient, happy quality to the whole performance.
Well, let's hear it.
Thank you.
Just a closer walk with thee from Arthur Blythe's newest album. And my guest is Gary Giddens. He's the jazz critic for the Village Voice, and a collection of his essays from the 1970s have just been compiled, published by the Oxford Press under the title Writing on a Blue Note, Jazz and American Pop. We were talking about a lot of jazz musicians going back to earlier jazz and pop standards, and favorites of churches and missions around the country, like what we just heard.
You asked earlier about music that I was nostalgic about.
Yeah.
One of the records I'm most nostalgic about in jazz is a 1954 recording by George Lewis, not the trombonist, but the old New Orleans-born clarinetist, of Just a Closer Walk with Thee. And they do it very straight and with a lot, and it's a very beautiful performance, and it swings more in the second and third choruses like this. But interestingly, they also play with a big, fat, wavering vibrato, because that's that style that we associate with the Salvation Army, but which they associate with their childhood in churches. And I think it's just wonderful that everything here works together. You can really hear Arthur's roots. And he's having fun with the piece, but he's also playing it with great feeling and respect.
Yeah. Some new musicians now are incorporating elements of like rhythm and blues into their work. And this reminds me of a story that you told in one of your essays about how I guess Cecil Taylor must have been in your house.
Oh, yes.
You want to tell about that?
Just that this was when I was in college, and I'll tell you a little bit more if it's not in the book. I went to see him at his loft, and because I had already just started to become very excited about his music. Didn't quite understand it. And I was booking all the music when I was in college in Iowa. I'd gotten this plum position there. And so I wanted to arrange for him to come for 4 days and to give a couple of workshops and to give a concert and maybe speak and all this sort of stuff. So I don't know how the hell I got in contact with him, but he invited me up to his loft, and I went up there. And, well, I'm not going to go into a rundown of Cecil's personality, but he's not the most talkable fellow in the world, unless you interview him, in which case you don't do anything except turn the tape recorder on, and it's like pushing a button and he goes on for 90 minutes, and you have to figure out later what he said. So I said to him if he'd like to do it, and he said yeah, and we agreed on a sum. And he was on his piano covered with little white cocktail napkins with rings from drinks and such. So I took one of the cocktail napkins and I wrote out a makeshift contract, and I went back to Iowa with this with this damp cocktail napkin, and they looked at me as though I were crazy, but they honored it. And that was the contract for Cecil Taylor's 4 days in Grinnell. Well, the first evening he got there, we were sitting around somebody's large room listening to music and drinking and talking and having a good time. And he wanted to hear. It was funny. It was him and Jimmy Lyons, Sam Rivers, and Andrew Cyril. Marl's musician too. They all are. And Cecil and Sam came into my room. Sam wanted something to read himself to sleep. So what did he pick? I had several hundred books on the wall, and he decided Descartes' Essays was just the thing. So that's what he wanted. And Cecil wanted to listen to something, and I had this wonderful jazz collection. It's actually just a very small, but for being in college and having bought them all with real money, I was very proud of it. And had pretty much stopped listening to anything but jazz and some classical things. And he's looking through the records, and he's just impassive and bored. And he says, "Don't you have anything by James Brown?" So I was just destroyed. But he finally agreed on Bobby Bland, who was a passion of mine then. So he went back and listened to Bobby Bland, and Sam went to read Descartes, and the rest of us, I think.
What did you do?
The rest of us went back into the room, Jimmy and Andrew and about 10 or 12 of the people on the campus who knew who they were, and we just listened to various like jazz recordings. I can't remember who the hell we listened to. Probably Coltrane. That's all anybody listened to then.
Well, James Brown's music seems to come into play in Ornette Coleman's new music.
Oh, James Brown is an axiom in American music. It was my fool ignorance. No, he's a very important musician, very gifted in terms of the rhythms and the stark nature of his recordings and the sound of his voice and everything else.
I'd like to play a excerpt of one of Ornette Coleman's recent compositions from a fairly recent album. But he's working with a lot of new concepts and with a different use of like two rhythm sections, and he has a theory or a concept that he calls harmelotics. Let me ask you, Gary, to explain a little bit about what he says he's doing with the music and what it means to you as a listener.
Well, first of all, harmelotics is not an explainable theory. It is a wonderful smokescreen that covers a lot of different areas in Ornette's thinking. But it does not have a set of rules. And I say this based on having asked everybody I could think of to explain it to me. And at one point, I thought I understood it pretty well, only to realize that it really cannot be explained that easily. There are a lot of rules in the music that he and Blood Ulmer and Shannon Jackson are doing right now. For example, in Blood's work, and I think I'm sure it comes from Ornette, one of the things that they do is they keep a drone chord that Blood, no matter what he's soloing, he will keep going back to that drone note. He tunes his guitar differently, incidentally, for every tune that they play. And with that going around, they will modulate into various keys, and they have to listen very closely. And at some point, one person will come up with the next key change, and then they will all kind of zoom into that. Harmelotics allows them to think of keys in certain relationships that are different from the standard, the way we think about it, having been brought up on the temperate scale. But I don't think it's a text yet, in the way, for example, that George Russell's Lydian concept was.
Sometimes it sounds like they're playing in different keys. Musicians are playing in different
keys.
That
was my feeling. And in fact, I say that in the book, that one of the things that the harmelotics allowed them to do is to pose two or three keys against each other. Roger Trilling, who is Blood Ulmer's manager, tells me that that's not exactly right. He says it sometimes happens that they're playing into it, but it has more to do with the fact of trying to modulate around the same key as opposed to deliberately going into keys that knock up against each other. I wish, and I said this to all of them, that they would explain this in the liners to their record. I think it's an, because there is a concept there, and they work very hard at it. And instead of just making it a kind of a pea soup of musical gobbledygook, why don't they come out and write in a very concise and clear way what it is when they put the piece together? I've heard them explain it. I mean, I know it can be done. And I think it would be very interesting, certainly to people musically oriented. I mean, not just listeners, but people who know something about the way music is made, to be able to find out about it. In my own attempts at research, I frequently run into a blank wall, and I noted with great interest that all of the interviews that have recently appeared with Ornette Coleman, none of them even attempt to explain this. And I don't know if they're simply remiss in asking him the key questions, or if Ornette just came back with his famous double talk.
Well, we're going to hear a piece of his from a recent album called Macho Woman, and I don't know what the title means, so I'll just just drop that. But this is from an album called Body Made It. Do you want to say anything about this piece before we hear it? And I think we'll only have time to excerpt the piece.
just as this is a session from 1976, and unfortunately, Ornette's records have come out long after they were made, and so they're not really indicative of where he's at the time that they come out, and this is unfortunate. But this does show you the fact that because it's, again, it seems to me that because you're hearing more than one key at the same time, that a lot of sonic territory is covered. You don't have that very tight consonant harmonic sense that you get in all traditional music. And one of the things that I've noted is that if you hum along with the theme, you can do it in any key and you'll sound in tune.
That's interesting. Okay, well, let's hear this. For purposes of time, we're going to have to leave that composition in progress, but I think that will give you a taste of the kind of music that Ornette Coleman is playing now. My guest again is Gary Giddens, the jazz critic for The Village Voice and the author of a new book called Writing on a Blue Note, Jazz and American Pop. I think a lot of people hearing that, particularly for the first time, are baffled because it is such a radical departure, not only from what he's played, but from what everybody's played before. Do you have a different relationship to this now? Do you feel differently about it than you did the first time you put on Dancing in Your Head?
Well, I loved Dancing in Your Head the first time I heard it. In fact, I think in some ways I overrated it, but it just knocked me out, the freshness of the sound. My most vivid memory of listening to Ornette has to do with the first times I heard him when he was playing. Because, you see, having listened to him when in the quartets and the trios, I don't find this that different. It's a question of, sure, you're more aware of different harmonic sense and, of course, the electric colors and the rhythms. But Ornette's basically playing the same way. It's the same sound, and it's the same way of putting together a solo using riffs and screams and various melodic things and certain thematic continuity. The first time I listened to Ornette, I think the first time everybody listens to Ornette, it's a terrifying thing because since he doesn't resolve himself harmonically the way you expect, it's like you're constantly floating in the air with him and you never know when you're going to land. Where's the tonic? Where do you come down to rest for a second? Where do you breathe? And it's only after you really listen to him and you realize that he is working with themes and carrying them, and you slow down the music in your own head so that you can follow him note for note, that you can kind of get his sense of breathing, because his whole idea of phrasing is just as revolutionary as anything else. He never stops where you expect him to stop. And he doesn't think in terms of the usual resolutions. He's got an amazing ear. The cuteness of his ear is astonishing, because if you think about it, first of all, he's figured out a way of playing with a tone that almost borders on a series of quarter notes. And yet he's always in tune with himself. And of course, he had to invent other musicians who could follow him and be in tune with him.
And some of them are now going off on their own.
Although Charlie Hayden, I spoke to about 2 weeks ago, and he told me two things, which you will have a scoop here. Don't blame me, however, if they don't come true. Okay. He did tell me that they are attempting, Ornette would like to put together a meeting of Prime Time and Old and New Dreams, which incidentally I predicted in my book. And the other thing he told me is that Ornette is considering that he may do something with Cecil. So I think that would be just extraordinary if it comes off.
Gary, we're running out of time. I'd like to quote something from your book and just ask you how this is applied to yourself. You could read this if you like, or I'll do it for you. Okay, here we go. this is quoting from an essay called The Whiteness of the Whale, which is an essay about Art Pepper, who's a white musician who feels in some ways that he's been discriminated against amongst jazz musicians for being white. But you're in this part of the essay writing about him as a white musician. Part of the myth of the hipster musician is that he makes it to the other side, but like Orpheus, can't or won't return. Or at least this is the myth of the white fan who seeks in jazz the intimacy of blackness, fearing it all the same. In the Midwest during the 60s, I heard several stories about pilgrims who made the journey to Charlie Parker's Kansas City neighborhood or gravesite and never lived to tell about it. For some reason, the stories seemed believable then and were accepted for their cautionary value, i.e., get as close to the music as you can, white boy, but don't go beyond the music. You're a white critic and deal with a lot of black music and black musicians. Has the blackness of the music or many of the people who play it been anything unusual for you? Or are you involved in that lure in any of the ways that you describe it?
Well, I think, of course, the lure is impossible to ignore. The fact of the matter is that when you look at American music and American cultural mores, the impact of blacks on the way all of us think and feel about music is completely disproportionate.